Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. You know what I'm about to say, and you want to click forward 30 seconds, but please hear me out. We've a lot of stuff coming your way this week, including the podcast that went out already with young journalist Mahmoud Mushtaha, who is on the ground in Gaza. And it's actually some uplifting stuff. It's not all doom and gloom as we've been used to. So there's some good news there, and that's available right now on the Patreon feed. So that's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So if you're not a member, please join us. Help us keep going in 2024. I know I keep saying it's the year of elections, but it really is. And we've lots and lots that we want to cover. And we want to be able to continue to have tough conversations with people who are putting themselves forward as the alternative, and tough conversations with people who are putting themselves forward as the almighty. So if you can, if you have a few quid, if you think you met us down the shops and you said, would you grab a cup of coffee, and you throw us the price for a cup of coffee, this is the way to do it. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And for that, you're getting a ton of additional content, all of our podcasts in one consolidated feed, and they're entirely plea free. So you don't have to listen to me beg. But unfortunately, independent media means just that. We have no ads. We have no sponsors. We want to remain completely independent and free from all corporate interests and editorial oversight that are linked to these corporate interests. So if you can, if you like what we do, if you're one of the thousands of people who are listening, and while you know it's free, you understand that there is a value to it, then please give something back. Last time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I'll shut up now. Enjoy the show.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Niamh McRae, and you're very welcome to the Moose Cult podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Kath Brown from UCD. And I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with her about her really fascinating research into the experiences of those who are opposed or who have concerns about particular developments in sexualities and genders, equality in relation to sexualities and genders. So Kath, you're really welcome to Moose Cult. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Kath, you're a professor of social and cultural... you're welcome. You're a professor of social and cultural geography. And you're very prolific and you've researched extensively, but what we're particularly going to focus on today, you've researched extensively on people's spatial experiences of sexualities and genders. And a key focus of your work over the last decade or so has been on the impact of legislative changes to sexual and gender equalities. And notably, and this is hopefully going to be part of our discussion, one of your goals is to use research to make a difference to people's lives. So we're going to talk about your project called Beyond Opposition, which has been funded by the European Research Council. No small achievement in itself, and on which you are working alongside your longtime collaborator, Catherine Nash, amongst others. So the project has two core goals. Firstly, to understand the everyday experiences of people who are opposed to or who have concerns about legislative and cultural changes around issues like same-sex marriage, abortion, gender self-identification, and other forms of sexual and gender equality. And secondly, and this is really fascinating, you wish to explore and seek to experiment in addressing the social polarization that has emerged between people occupying different standpoints on some of these issues. So I just want to start off by saying that the project is really fascinating. It's unusual and it's ambitious. And in many ways, it's a very courageous project. So for reasons I hope we can explore. So probably just to kick off, Kath, could you tell us a little bit about the scale of this project and its different stages or elements? You know, like, for example, how many people have you interviewed or surveyed and where are they based and that kind of thing?
So Beyond Opposition started in terms of the research I was doing with Catherine Nash, and that began the heteroactivism research I was doing with Catherine Nash. That began in 2012 when I was visiting Catherine to do some work, and she said we should really look at these kind of fringe groups. And by 2020, when we finished doing the project and published the heteroactivism book, they were no longer fringe by any stretch. But we started looking at their arguments and how they were countering same-sex marriage in particular at that stage. And we were looking and kind of LGBT equalities more broadly. And we looked specifically at the UK and Canada because these were places where same-sex marriage was pretty much embedded in Canada. By that stage, it was 2015. In the UK, it was going through Parliament virtually unopposed in 2013. But there was, you know, there was opposition in the UK, and there was a petition online and things like that that went, you know, that had a significant number of signatories. But what was interesting about that was we thought that the way they were making their arguments was very, very different to what people were expecting and what people might be expecting to see. So the Heteroactivism Project looked at how these groups sought to reestablish what they saw as a loss of heterosexuality to society and the centrality of heterosexuality to society. And they were particularly interested in children, which is not unusual, but they weren't making arguments about paedophilia. They weren't making arguments about gay necessarily being wrong. They were framing their discussions much more in what we might term an equalities language, but also the superiority of heterosexuality. And they also weren't making religious kind of claims. So we wrote the book looking at the different ways these things were being claimed. But the reason I came to Beyond Opposition was during that research. I went along to one of their conferences as part of the research. We did participant observation. And it was one of the first conferences I'd been to. It was really distressing and upsetting for me as a lesbian parent. And, you know, they were calling lesbian parenting child abuse and this kind of thing. But at one point in the conference, what took me by total surprise was a moment of empathy where there was a parent there whose child was transitioning. And they were very worried about the state, about other people intervening in their child's life and not allowing her, in their terms, to become the woman that God wanted her to be. And for me, all I could think was, if that was my child in 1995, I would have felt the same. And I would have been really upset about state intervention, about my child potentially, having to experience these things, but in relation to same-sex marriage. Now, the project has moved from that kind of form of radical empathy towards thinking about how we might live together if we can't agree, but it started there. And so the scale of the project, so after that point, I applied to the ERC. It's a big project. It's a consolidator fund. It works across the UK, Canada and Ireland, all places where we see, you know, what Jeffrey Weeks termed the world we have won, apparently. You know, they had to have, so the rules that I had was they had to have same-sex marriage in place, they had to have abortion rights in place, they had to have some form of trans equalities in place, and that varied. But, you know, Ireland was actually the best at that stage. And they had to speak in English because we wanted to look at that kind of transnational interconnections as well. So at the moment, we've done over 160 interviews with people who are opposed to or concerned about the changes to sexual and gender legislations and, you know, the social changes associated with that. So we are interested in thinking about what it means to be on the side that if Jeffrey Weeks says we're winning, what does it feel like to be on the side that's losing? The argument about losing and winning is not really something we're interested in, but it's about that discussion of how do you create, or what does it feel like to be the ones that disagree with the mainstream, or what the mainstream is supposed to be. And then, as you say, the second part of the project is looking at how we might address social polarization around these issues. And there it's not thinking about how do we change people's minds, although that might be a very laudable aim. The question is more, if we are going to live beside each other, and the data all suggests that we're not going to change everybody's minds, that not everybody's ever going to agree with same-sex marriage or abortion or gender recognition, then what do we do? What do we do with people who will disagree? So it takes a premise that you can't change everybody's mind, which some might disagree with. It also takes the premise that we need to live alongside those whose minds we can't change. And I guess it's a very 21st century project. You know, in the 20th century, this project wouldn't exist because we were still fighting for space, fighting for rights, fighting for all kinds of things, fighting to change the entire system. And of course, people are still doing all those things. But there is a shift in our society. There's a shift in our legal system, and there's a shift in our kind of social acceptances. And we have a lot of research out there that explores the limits of these shifts for people who are seeking abortions, or LGBT people, or trans people. You know, there is research out there, but actually nobody's ever asked people who don't agree with these changes what it means for them. So although I take a very different view, you know, my own positioning has been a woman who's trans inclusive, you know, or seeks to be a good trans ally and, you know, pro-choice. What does it mean to occupy this space at this time? So it's very, I think, probably controversial in some ways and probably quite mainstream in other ways.
You know, it's a really interesting, it's a fascinating premise. And it is, it's an unusual project, you know. So, you know, we can kind of get into that. So maybe let's start off by, you've kind of situated the project by looking at some of your key findings in relation to this grouping. And I know you want to move beyond categorization to an extent, but you've written that one of your key findings so far is the differences within your sample, i.e. between those who indicate that they are, within those who indicate that they are opposed to or concerned about some of the rights and equalities that you're interested in. Would you like to maybe speak a little bit to that theme, Kath?
So we really, really upset them at the start. So we were doing our best to be inclusive and like to try and get people to speak to us. And one of the first things we did was we put up a questionnaire because we just started COVID. So we were struggling to go to events or anything like that. So we put up a questionnaire in the hope that we could get people to answer the questionnaire and then they would come for an interview. And one of the, you know, questionnaires have exclusion questions. And we wanted to speak to people who fit the category of people we wanted to engage with. So we put up tick boxes, which is very bad for a queer researcher to ever put up tick boxes. And it turns out it's equally bad if you're exploring who we thought were them. And, you know, and when I conceptualized the research, I think I did see a homogenous group of people. And they very quickly came back and told us how much they were not. So I think, you know, there's a couple of learnings there. In activism, in academia, we very often presume a homogenous mass of another that we don't necessarily investigate. And the group that we were talking to were not a homogenous mass. They were individuals with very, very different opinions. Very often as well, this group gets kind of lumped in with things like the far right or, these broader kind of considerations. And again, that is inaccurate. It's an inaccurate depiction. So very specifically told that, you know, for gender critical feminists, they're not anti-same-sex marriage. And they're also not... often very, very much pro-choice for people who are pro-life and, you know, against, they're not necessarily against same-sex marriage. You know, they can be actually very supportive of, say, migrant rights because they might see themselves as what they term consistent life. All lives are important. You know, so these positionings are very, very different and then their experiences are very different. You know, so the presumption that they're, you know, right-wing, Trump supporters, all that kind of thing, was really, really problematic. And even in Ireland, you know, we see that in the 2018 referendum, where you have all kinds of people coming out on the no side that aren't, you know, don't fit that category, that stereotype, that caricature. And I think understanding that caricature is a caricature, it's a stereotype, it does particular things, and maybe it's useful in some ways. But from an academic perspective, it's not accurate. And that was that is a key finding. You know, there isn't a them and us. Very often the them is part of the us and the us is part of the them. And that challenges all kinds of ways in which we see the world, often through enemy and ally, often through you're either, you know, you're either for us or you're against us, and those kind of very binary things that might be very useful in a kind of activist sense. But when you get into this kind of research, are hugely problematic. What it also does is say that although these views and these people can be deployed, activated, radicalized, people of all kinds of words, into particular camps to get particular things done, they're not necessarily friends. They don't necessarily agree. And they're not this homogenous enemy. And that in some ways disrupts the scariness of maybe this group and these broader organizations.
Yeah.
Because there's very often a discussion of, say, left and right, where the left is totally disunified and the right is this unified, coherent mass of people that's coming to get us. You know, that's inaccurate in this context around gender and sexuality. People occupy all kinds of positions, both in terms of their broader politics and we can talk about their experiences in those broader political spheres, and also in terms of their relationships and their discussions of kind of gender and sexuality. And again, the most obvious ones are probably those people who term themselves gender critical feminists, who are often lesbians. Some are in same-sex marriages. You know, they don't fit this narrative that we have. And that's not to say that some people, that's the case for everybody. Some people are.
Yeah.
You know, they would be anti-immigration, they would be anti-abortion, they're anti-same-sex marriage, they're anti-trans inclusion, like they're anti, you know, everything, and would see themselves as kind of upholding civilization in that kind of way. But it's not everyone, and that's really, really key.
And do you think there's political possibilities in that discovery of the heterogeneity of the group, or...
Yeah,
I don't know. Does it just make our lives more complicated?
I mean, it makes our lives more complicated, but that's where academics, they're
already,
it's all complex.
Exactly. We're already complicated,
No, I think absolutely that there, you know, the presumption that people are either good or evil underpins it. And if you're good, you're on my side. And if you're evil, you're on the other side. Complicating those assumptions is what feminists have done for decades. We used to call it strategic. Strategic alliances, strategic essentialism, you know, and making those strategic alliances in order to fulfill particular goals, whatever those goals might be, has been a crucial part of feminism. So, yes, I think it makes it more complicated. I think it also, you know, the challenge of it, challenging of a homogenous enemy humanizing people.
Yeah,
I think changes how we approach the other side, because there is no other side.
And you've noted a lot in your work. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. You've noted a lot that this is in keeping with a lot of queer theory anyway. Did you want to maybe explain, because some of our listeners mightn't be familiar with that, the degree to which queer theory has tried to break down those binaries in the first place?
Yeah, and queer theory was all about challenging categorization and binaries, particularly around sexuality and gender, but also more broadly, with the idea that there is, for example, not just two genders, or there's not just homosexuality and heterosexuality. Mm. And in categorizing people in that way, we were creating particular power relationships. Mm-hmm. So queer has spent decades challenging those power relationships that create and reiterate binaries in ways that are exclusionary and don't necessarily fit people. So for me to say, you know, for me to say all queer people are not the same is not revolutionary. No. But for me to say, actually, if we deploy a queer lens to people who are concerned or opposed to gender and sexual, socio-legal changes to gender and sexuality, is because that isn't how these groups are seen. So it's quite a, we presume it of some groups, but not of others. Yeah. So yes, so for queer theory, there is no categories. Categories are normative creations that might allow us to do particular things, but there's no fixity to them.
And we might as well, actually, that was kind of, I suppose, that leads us into one of your papers that you've published on. You write about how the group of people that you're interested in now, how they experience public space. Mm. And I suppose one of the other insights, of course, of earlier queer scholarship has been to show the heteronormativity of public space. In other words, how gender or sexually non-conforming people were excluded, threatened, invisibilized in public space. But your current research seemed to show something different. So firstly, it shows how the social and legislative changes that have brought about greater inclusion of LGBT plus people have changed how people experience public space. So maybe you could speak to that a little bit first in terms of the changes in terms of their LGBT plus inclusion and visibility. And then we can move on to maybe how I keep saying the other group, but you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah, so there have been extensive changes in public spaces that doesn't make them safe for all LGBTQ plus mm-hmm. people. And it's important mm-hmm. to kind of keep reiterating
for
that
sure,
when I'm doing
sure.
the project. Yeah. Like, there's still a very important exclusionary element to society, and it is still heteronormative, much and all, as certainly the group I'm looking at likes to challenge that. Yeah. But there have been extensive changes to public spaces. I mean, rainbow flags on, you know, on big buildings during Pride, you know, the ways in which public spaces can be used by same-sex couples, for example. You know, all of those things have changed what is experienced and expected in mm-hmm. public space and how they're experienced and how they're experienced by people. So for LGBT groups and organizations, there's an ability to be visible in a way that wasn't feasible or safe in the kind of 1990s or would have experienced kind of state and police oppression. We don't mm-hmm. tend to now have extensive amounts of police raiding bars or yeah. trying to out LGBT people, or particularly gay men. Mm-hmm. So the public sphere has changed. We have a gay Taoiseach who, you know, who is out about his sexuality. We also have legislation that prohibits kind of discrimination in workplaces. Things have changed. That doesn't yeah. mean they're perfect, but they've
for
changed.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And so what this research was looking at is, you know, this change, what does it mean for people who don't agree with the change, who really struggle with it, and where are they encountering these experiences, where are they having their views, or where do they feel comfortable and uncomfortable expressing these views?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that, there's a couple of ways that people talk about both public space, but also their place in terms of broader society. So a lot of times people will recognize that they're a minority. You know, particularly in Ireland, they know that they were only part of the 33% who voted no, say, for example, in the 2018 referendum mm-hmm. or in the 2015 referendum. So they know that their views are not replicated more broadly, mm-hmm. Or they think they're the silent majority. So they believe that their views, if they were exposed more broadly in the media, would actually be taken up by other people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're looking at kind of abortion and same-sex marriage in, say, places like Ireland, that's a difficult argument to make. But when you're looking at things like trans inclusions and gender critical feminisms, that kind of silent majority argument tends to come out more.
Yeah, yeah.
So for these groups, they see themselves often as a minority. And that's a significant change from yeah. where we were in the kind of 1990s, where you have state support for their views. Yeah. You know, you have this kind of, and they will talk about the changes, you know, particularly those people who were alive in the 1990s, you know, mm-hmm. will talk about those changes, how there's been this shift in culture from when their views were just expected. It was part mm-hmm. of the norm. In fact, anything different to that was what would be challenged.
Yeah.
And now they're in the position where their views and opinions are seen as wrong, and they're seen as outdated, mm-hmm. or they're seen as dangerous, mm-hmm. and they have to navigate that then in mm-hmm. public space. So where mm-hmm. they choose to speak, where they don't choose to speak, how they choose mm-hmm. to speak, and in what ways. So mm-hmm. what Catherine and I talked about in that paper was these kind of shifting positions that they experienced, and how it played out in their lives. And what we wanted to challenge was the notion, again, it kind of comes back to this binary of yeah. of include, you're either excluded or you're privileged.
Yeah.
So we didn't, you know, we're not going to argue that cisgender heterosexual people are, you know, their identities are not privileged, but their views are definitely not privileged or not the norm mm-hmm. in the places that we were looking at. Mm-hmm. And that means that they're not privileged in the kind of sense of what privilege is. Mm-hmm. But neither would we argue that they're systematically marginalized or excluded. And so we tend to work on that binary, maybe often unthinkingly, that you're mm-hmm. either this or you're that. But there's something that this group does that's neither of those two things. Like, their views aren't privileged, but neither are they excluded for being heterosexual or cisgendered. And yet, if they say something about abortion or if they say something about same-sex marriage, they can experience all kinds of things. So they can experience things like on the internet being trolled. They can experience, you know, if they're activists, they expect to be attacked, like physically attacked, verbally attacked, if they're just going about their daily business. They can expect, or they expect and have experienced, various forms of employment issues, whether that's losing employment, whether that's just being sanctioned in some way, that kind of thing. And so there are consequences to them holding these opinions. But it's not systematic exclusion like we've understood it and theorized it to date around, say, gender, sexuality or race. It's not that society has become, you know, homosexual. Their views and opinions are making them stand outside of the dominant hegemonic norm. And so in that, and this is where I wish I was more creative, in that we need a name for it because it's neither one nor the other. And that's what the paper that we published was trying to make, that argument that in the 21st century landscape, we're not looking at the same thing anymore. When we look at privilege and marginalization, where around kind of heteronormativities, that isn't the experience people are having. And again, that isn't to say that LGBT people are all living their best lives or that society has totally changed. But it is to point to the ways in which these things are experienced and what that means for people's everyday lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the data that, I mean, do you want to maybe speak a little bit further to that theme around how it's impacted on their work and their activism and the effects of some of their experiences of those who are in favour of the legislative changes you talked about, and how in the sense sometimes that almost solidified and kind of galvanised some of their activism around some of these issues.
Yeah, and this is the paper we haven't published yet. Yes, absolutely. So what we found was there was various kind of ways that people reacted to this. So one of the most obvious ways is perhaps they were very, very scared. So some people were even scared to have us record the interview in case they were associated with these views. They were worried about being attacked. They were worried about their job. They were worried about all kinds of things. And again, from sexualities research from the 1990s, we know that those fears are very, very powerful, regardless of if they are based in anything that is kind of real. The fear of this happening to you can have all kinds of effects. So people, you know, were very, very nervous, or some people were very, very nervous talking to the project. Now, on the other scale, some people were like, I say what I want when I want. You know,
and there are
that group of people as well, who are very clear about who they are. Very often they occupy kind of their managers or their own businesses, or they have some kind of, or they're retired. They have some kind of distance from, you know, the potential effects of this, given the legislation that's in place. But then there's a group of people who became, or who told us that because of their experiences, they became political, what they called political. So the example that I always use is Harry. So Harry was tweeted, and you know, we basically take participants at their word. We're not trying to second guess them. So Harry tweeted, which is something we can talk about again, but Harry tweeted, or told us that he tweeted about Transgender Day of Remembrance, how it wasn't a thing, and, you know, that kind of content. And he had the police turn up at his door. And the police or somebody then published it in the media. And so then Harry received significant, and Harry's family received significant amounts of death threats, rape threats for his family. They posted pictures of a nearby kind of pub where they said, you know, and posted these kind of not so veiled threats. And Harry told us that he was not political beforehand, like he would be on Twitter and he would make his views known. But he wasn't political, is what he said. And he, by the end of this experience, had taken a judicial review through the police. And first he did this kind of online Twitter summary. He took a judicial review. He galvanized a whole load of people. And he was then able to use his experience and his expertise as it had become to support others, to support some quite high profile people. And also, Harry was based in the UK, he was able to stop certain trans-inclusive policies going through, things like the court prosecution service or, you know, various elements of that. So Harry was probably, you know, the most obvious example of, I didn't, you know, I wrote this and I'm very proud of writing that. But when it came back to hit me, how I pushed back on that was very... it galvanized him and created all kinds of opportunities actually for him and has now become quite an important and effective activist for gender critical.
I mean, it raises so many questions, like you know what I mean, like it really raises questions around should LGBT plus activists be advocating for hate speech for state-sanctioned kind of,
and I mean, I'm not a criminal justice person or a lawyer, but what I think this research shows is what we think we're doing and what the effects might be are very potentially quite distant. So if I could give you another example of of Venice. So Venice was organizing an event where. For Venice, again, Venice told us that she wanted to organize an event where people were going to talk to each other around trans stuff, that there were questions, and she organized the kind of gender critical side, and she organized trans people and trans allies to be part of it. The trans kind of side dropped out, and they decided to go ahead with the event anyway. The event was protested, the police were involved, somebody was injured and hurt, and Venice basically said... it didn't get big until people started protesting it. And they then, you know, it didn't get big until it was cancelled, is what she said. And she said because of the publicity of that kind of response, that meant that they had all these all this support, and they ran a number of other events. Now, that kind of narrative we don't hear. And we see success in particular ways. And I think that success is really important for people, and it can feel really empowering to be part of those kind of protests. It can be a really key thing. And I'm not suggesting that we don't do them. But I think unless we understand these stories and these opinions, what we're doing is reproducing particular forms of power relations that we maybe want to think about and question. So when you ask about hate crime speech, you know, queer and abolitionist researchers have for a long time said the police in the state is a problematic institution that targets racialized and working class people. So maybe we also want to think, how do we engage with people we disagree if we have the little bit of power that we maybe have? And again, with all the caveats that I keep saying about the lack of power, there is also opportunities here around what else might we do? How else might we work together? Or what are the other ways? So and you know, I always say, you know, in the 1983 referendum, how were people who were pro-choice treated? And how do you want to treat the people from the 2018 referendum, because it's not like anyone changed their mind, you know, from those group of people who were pro-choice in 1983. And in fact, you know, things grew in all kinds of ways. Now, I'm not suggesting this really easy swing either way, but I am suggesting we have an opportunity here to really consider the kind of society we want to live in and then look at how we might create it. And I guess then when you talk about changing the world, that's where I am with thinking about changing the world. You know, what is the kinds of, if we're not going to educate it, you know, these views out to people, which I think, again, the Irish referendum shows isn't really possible. You couldn't argue in 2015 or 2018 that the people who voted no didn't know the arguments of the yes side. You know, it's not dying out. There are young people very much involved in these organizations and movements. So all the assumptions that this is just going to be some kind of utopia that where everybody agrees with us is are hugely problematic. Yeah. So then the question becomes, well, what do we do?
Yeah.
And well, I don't have an answer to that question, just to be clear. Okay.
Well, maybe I was going to leave this later, but maybe we can continue on that theme, because I do want to obviously come back to some of the methodological issues that you've touched on, Kath. But you mentioned that that thing about, like, how do we learn to live side by side? And I know you're just thinking these things through, and as you just said, that you don't have an answer. Like, I know, and in what you've written so far, and I know you're still writing and thinking and publishing, that, you know, it's tentative, but. And I was really struck by that, the way, and you've touched on this already, that a key question for feminist/LGBT movements is, what do we do when we feel both under threat and simultaneously we are gaining some forms of power? And as you said, the second pillar of it is, so you've had workshops with people, bringing together people from who hold these different views, as I understand it, with those who obviously would be in favour of the equalities that you're concerned with. Even could you just even tell me, like what was that like? What happened? What came out of it? Or, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think they happened, which was something we weren't sure was even possible.
Yeah,
You know, so just to kind of to name that, like, we don't actually get in rooms together except to debate, and even then, those can be hugely traumatic events. So the whole point of the workshops wasn't, and one of the rules of the workshop wasn't, that you weren't allowed to debate the issues. You weren't allowed to try and change somebody else's mind. You were to accept, even just for a short period of time, that people were going to hold these views, and then explore how we might live together in the space itself. I think we were very nervous.
Yeah.
It took 6 months of planning just to get the first one up and running, to get people into the room, to get the ethics through.
I can imagine.
But to do it as safely as we could. The workshops are critiquable. You know, we didn't talk about the issues. We didn't address issues of power in that kind of way, as would be normal in, you know, reconciliation or things like that.
Yeah.
So we got people into a room. We asked them to do discussion groups where they spoke about this very question. So what do you do, or how might we live in a world where we don't agree? You know, what are the ways that, say, that could operate in work? What are the ways it could operate at home? What are the ways in which this might play out? And then we asked them to do a arts-based workshop. So in Ireland, we did... we created this amazing tablecloth with lots of wedges. In Canada, we created a song. And in Scotland, we did drama. And we asked them to work together again with that kind of utopic vision. What does the future look like? What does the ideal future look like? And it was really, really, I think, difficult for people to do and to engage with. So I was like, you know, a huge gratitude to people who chose to be in those rooms. What was really interesting is people wanted to be in the rooms. People wanted to think about not fighting and think about how we might live together. They wanted to change people's minds. Of course they did. And there was a kind of, you know, an emphasis, but they also wanted to learn about each other. You know, they wanted, and we didn't allow space for that. So I know that they wanted that because they told us they wanted it, when we didn't really allow space for, you know, why did people hold those views? What was it? You know, what were those views, and why were they holding them in that way? To actually learn about the human, I think, behind the, you know, the poster or whatever it was. And so we learned that it's possible. It's possible to put people in a room to have these discussions. And I think even that possibility shows us something that we didn't know before. We learned that people wanted to be in the room. And we learned that there's not necessarily easy answers, because the utopia of one necessarily cancels out the utopia of another. There, how do we create the imperfect? What does that look like? And I guess even asking those questions, even forcing people to think in that way, to me was huge. It doesn't necessarily get us past the impasse, but to name the impasse is really, really important. Because in naming it, we're not just trying to fight for space. We're saying, okay, so now what? What do we do in this way? And I think, you know, I often compare the project to, you know, or where it could go next, I guess, in terms of peace studies and peace processes, which don't necessarily address gender and sexuality in this way. But thinking about Northern Ireland or, you know, those kinds of contexts where you do have people who fundamentally disagree living side by side in imperfect ways, creating imperfect institutions.
Yeah.
But there is, so there is potential, I think, in exploring more that question, but also even holding that question as we go about making hate crime legislation, as we go about thinking about policies or planning, or, you know, what are the ways in which we want to live together and what makes that feasible and possible.
Yeah.
So I don't have an easy solution.
I think even asking, I think it's almost a radical act even to ask the question and to even put in place, start putting in place those groups. And I think the curiosity that you found for each, for, again, I mean, you know, for both sides in inverted commas, for each other, I think is itself so radically different from what we just see on Twitter or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
And what was interesting, I suppose, in the Irish workshop especially was the avoidance of the question. So the kind of working around things so you can still get on. Like people want to get on. They don't necessarily want to fight or to have those battles. Like I think people have to at times, but if people cannot, then they'll do their best to not, to go around and to try and find points of connection, to try and find points of commonality. And I used to joke when we were organizing it with the other people who were organizing that, you know, I don't want them to be friends. They don't need to be friends. And I'm not joking, at the end of every workshop, they were swapping numbers and being friends. And I was like, no, the whole point is they're not friends. You know, I don't want them to necessarily connect, because it's that, again, is too simple a solution. Oh, let's just be friends. Oh, let's overlook it. Like, we can't overlook these things. They're fundamental to who we are and fundamental to our society. So let's not try and just go around it and just be friends.
Kind of deodorize it. Yeah.
And the other thing I wasn't interested in was compromise or middle ground. Like, I wasn't interested in saying, well, you move this way and we'll move this way and eventually we'll find a middle ground. Because actually, what if neither of us want to move? And actually in moving, one or the other of us loses who we are or loses something fundamental. So it wasn't about that either. It wasn't, and that's the kind of misconception of even trying to do this work is that you're trying to find a compromise. You're trying to find a solution. You're trying to find a middle ground. And it's like, but what if there is no middle ground? What if there is no compromise? What if there is no solution? You know, and then it becomes a bigger question. And it is just, it comes back to that, how do we want to treat each other? You know, how do we want to live in a world where people are not going to agree?
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit, and maybe also your referencing of peace studies, there was, in our last series of the podcast, we interviewed Eilish Ward, who wrote a book about self, and who is a feminist and an activist, but also a Buddhist. And I think it does resonate a bit with what you're saying, because it was about, I suppose, holding on to your positions yet not holding on to yourself. You know what I mean? And maybe we do need the transcendental to help us. But you've already kind of hinted at this. I wanted to just talk a little bit more about the kind of ethical and methodological issues, because. Now, maybe you've moved away from this, but like you spoke about how your experience of the conference and how as a parent you would have, you know, you kind of almost had a visceral reaction as a parent. You talked about the people who lost in the 1983 abortion referendum. And so there was this kind of radical empathy at the heart of the project, certainly when I was reading it. And I suppose I'm just really interested, I suppose, to explore that. I know you've characterized this in one of your chapters as respectful relationalities. That's the kind of methodological approach. And you've kind of spoken to that already. But it's really complex, as you've already said, and it's also high risk. And you've suggested that it's open to critique. So I suppose if we could look at it from two different angles. So there was what was it like for you as a lesbian mother, or as somebody who's researched on these issues for a long time, as someone who's an active, and for your fellow researchers, just to hear some of what people had to say who opposed so deeply, some of the And it's not just issues. These are kind of really, a lot of the time, go to the core of maybe your identity and your sense of who you are. Like, what was that like ethically, emotionally, so to speak? And how did you manage that?
Hard. So the postdoctoral researchers did the interviews, and it was really, really difficult. And I kind of don't want to speak for them. So we've been publishing various things on the emotional labor is the next kind of thing we're going to publish. But, you know, that kind of area of doing this work. And I think what a lot of what they told me a lot of the time was it was almost harder because they were nice. They were nice people. They'd say something and then it would be totally like this kind of gut punch. And sitting there and having to listen to it was really, really difficult. We did try, you know, we asked people what their views were, but the focus of the interviews were on their experiences. So, you know, we'd ask them about their day lives. We'd ask them what brought them to the research, and that, but then we try and turn it back to, so how does that affect your home? Is there places you feel comfortable? Is there places you feel uncomfortable? And so the purpose wasn't really to get at people's views, because we pretty much thought we could find that, you know, in other ways. That didn't make it any easier. Also for, like, again, I can speak as the project lead, but not necessarily in the postdocs, but what, as a project lead, and I think what people need to recognize is the amount of emotional toil all of this kinds of research takes. Yeah. So I had to fight with the EU, but we have counseling as written into the project, and HR says I can't force people to go, but I have to. I strongly encourage everybody on the team who has any kind of frontline engagement to go along and explore the experiences of that with someone who is trained. I'm not trained to support the researchers. And what I would say is the emotional impact of research is often under-recognized, whether you're doing research with marginalized people or whether you're doing this quite confronting research. For me personally, I think the first time I heard, you know, so you read things online all the time.
I know,
but the first time I was in person and heard somebody say these things, and you realize that they're real people. And, you know, it was in one of these conferences, and the whole audience stands up and gives them a standing ovation. You know, that was just really affecting. It just really a moment where you think, okay, I didn't recognize that this was where we were. You know, and it was in England, and it was post-marriage equality, and it was still in, you know, pre-Brexit era. But there, that kind of experience is hugely, hugely confronting, because we do exist in our bubble, in all kinds of ways. So to talk about the kind of radical empathy, I think that's a possibility, but it's only one possibility amongst many, and that's why I've kind of pulled back away from it a bit, like finding commonality. I don't want us to think about how we do it, not prescribe how we should.
Okay.
And so that move to how do we live together where we don't agree. Some people would say, well, we have these community dialogues where we learn from each other, you know, and where we get to humanize the other, and we get to kind of just shift people a little bit, maybe. Other people would say, you know, we need to fight our battle. We need to hold our ground, or it's not for me. I can't do this. This isn't, you know, I just can't do this for my own health. All of those positions, I would argue, are valid. And in asking the questions, I don't think there's one position. So for other people, that radical empathy might be hugely important in achieving that particular goal. But I don't think we yet know what the goals are. Okay. And I think that's what the question this research asks that isn't answerable by what we already know. Because the goal is to allow LGBTQ plus people, women, you know, to give us rights, to allow us to live our free and liberated lives. And that's really important, of course. But that only deals with one sector of our society. What's the bigger goal? What else? How do we want other people to live in the world alongside us? And how do they want to live in the world alongside us is a very different goal. So that, I think, that's why I kind of moved away, stepped back from radical empathy, and in part because it felt like I was asking other people to do it, and I definitely wasn't. You know, for a lot of people, this kind of work is something that they would see you know, as hugely problematic, and I don't want to suggest that anyone should have to do it. In terms of how we did the research, and I think this is important, how do you get people in a room when they know you're the lesbian geographer, literally, who wrote the book on lesbian geographies, you know, and who's done all this work on kind of heteroactivism? How do you get convince them that you'll come into the room? And the answer was we wrote an ethos document that basically said, we'll listen to you. So if I was to say this was the ethos document we wrote when we were doing work with LGBT people, everybody'd be like, yeah, of course you did. Like, there's mm-hmm. nothing new about it. It's feminist research. We'll listen to you. We're not going to try and belittle you. We're not going to try and find a way to challenge you or to, you know, to undermine you. You know, so mm-hmm. a lot of research will either be covert or it will do it in a way that's, you know, and covert research is fine. But it'll do it in a way that's like, how do we find the evil people and name them and point at them and show how they're evil? That's not what this research did. So we talked about respectful relationalities, like, we will respect that you hold these views, and we will respectfully report on them, a report on your experiences of everyday spaces. And, you know, I hope that the project has achieved that to date. You know, I think if we hadn't, I'd imagine people would be onto us. Mm. They were onto us very quickly when we got it wrong at the start. You know, that actually, sometimes it's important to listen. Sometimes it's important to hear. And sometimes it's important to understand, even if you're not ever going to agree. And that's what this research does. So a respectful relationality is not that different to a kind of feminist methodology that says we should listen and we should hear and we should take people's word that what they say, this happens in their everyday lives, that's important evidence for research. You know, again, nothing hugely surprising, but it's this is a paper Carol and I are writing that Carol's leading on. You know, it's with the what might be termed the wrong people. You're not supposed to do that with these people because they're supposedly privileged. But, you know, here we are back in this privileged, marginalized binary, which is problematic as well.
And have you had pushback from people, you know, around the risk of creating a false moral equivalence between the two? Again, sorry to use the word sides, but you know what I mean? Between pro-equality and anti-equality on any of the particular issues that you've mentioned.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, why one of the first papers that's out there is about how it's not equivalent, you know, how because it isn't, you know, it isn't the same, that what people are experiencing is problematic, I would argue. We don't want people experiencing rape threats or, all that kind of thing. But it's not marginalization and exclusion in the ways that we've understood it to date. So there's something else. What is this something else we're trying to get at? But yes, you know, if you can explain and have time to explain the project, I think it's very clear that is exactly not what we're doing. It's not about finding the new other. It's about understanding the contemporary 21st century landscapes around gender and sexuality have altered beyond recognition, beyond what could have been hoped for in the 1980s. And that has effects for people who liked the kind of sexuality and gender landscapes of the 1980s and benefited from them. So yeah, I'd like to think that we counter it. People are very nice to your face, aren't they? So let's see what the comments, I don't know if you have comments open on this podcast, but let's see what they say.
It would be really interesting. Do you think, this might be an unfair question to end on, but do you think your research, because you use the phrase radical commonalities, and maybe again, you've moved beyond that, but do you think the possibilities maybe that have been shown through your research could be applicable to other social issues? Could they have wider resonances in other social issues?
Yeah, absolutely. A bit like the false equivalence, you know, we've been warned very clearly by Black feminists and others not to make assertions based on gender and sexuality into other areas around, say, anti-racism or things like that. And so I don't want to make assertions. What I hope is that, yes, I hope that even these considerations might be taken on board and they might offer different ways of thinking and different ways of being in the world, you know, and I can't speak to racial politics or migrant politics because I don't have that expertise, and I very clearly stay in my lane because what I'm doing is already controversial enough. So I hope that there is some useful learnings and considerations around these things. And of course, things like Brexit and just that kind of that very tough line between you're either for or you're against. And if you're for, you're all these things. And if you're against, you're all these other things. And that polarization. And I think probably where we can speak, or where this project definitely speaks to, is the notion of social polarization and how people fit into forms where they feel belonging, and what that does in terms of their activism. So the project started and is about the idea that we have these poles, and what are we going to do about that polarization that seems to be becoming stronger in ways that are maybe really, really unhelpful. And, you know, and I think Ireland is different to other places in terms of how it's addressed all kinds of things. And that is true of gender and sexuality as well. The notions of community, the notions of, you know, the lesbian down the road who's just a lesbian down the road, not, you know, kind of the scary person, you know, has always been a part of our communities. So I hope so, but I don't know. Until someone with that expertise takes it up.
Yeah. Well, Kath, you've certainly, I mean, it's the groundwork for so much more. And I know obviously you're going to be publishing more, and I'm dying to read it. So it's an absolutely fascinating project. It's so generative, and I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it today.
Thank you very much.